My great-grandparents were slaves. My grandparents were sharecroppers. And my parents were sharecroppers. And that meant that I was born a sharecropper. By the time I was walking, I was in the fields too. We couldn't go to school unless the working season was over and it rained. But the white kids, they got to go to school every day. All the teachers, they said education was a way of making a better life, and no one could take it away from me. I love school, so that's something that stuck with me. Doris and I got married. Doris was 17, and I was 19. We both saved up the month's salary for a bus ticket and left North Carolina for good. When I got to New Jersey, I started out as a laborer. I eventually became a supervisor and then a manager, so I had a lot of responsibilities. But there was a lot of prejudice. The white managers, they got perks. Some got cars, some got credit cards. I didn't get anything. In going to and from work, I got pulled over and harassed by the police a lot. More times than I can count. Was I angry? Hell yeah. But I had a family with 5 kids. Nothing could stop me from giving my kids a higher education so they can go farther than I have. I had to maintain myself and look at the goal that I had already set for my family. The current climate in America, all the murders by police to the black and brown communities, it hits me right in the face, brings it right back. You ask me what's possible right now. We just have to listen to one another. If you're prejudiced and I'm prejudiced, why don't we just sit down and talk? And maybe we'll find out we just prejudiced for nothing.
That video hit me right in the face and right in the heart. What a powerful encapsulation of the question, what's possible now? It's the story of a great-grandson of slaves who faced discrimination and who can clearly answer that question, what's possible now? I'm Baratunde Thurston, and welcome. I'll be your host this evening. I'm a writer, activist, comedian, producer, podcaster, who's not a podcaster, but really I am, of a show called How to Citizen with Baratunde. And I come to you from Los Angeles, California right now. I've seen you in the chat. Hello. 2020's been a lot. It's been a lot that we've been asked to carry, and I just want to acknowledge that and congratulate you on making it here. Thank you for being here with me and with us. I remember 4 years ago, this beautiful moment after a very painful moment. December 2016, Valerie Kaur, a great spiritual leader of the United States, said, "What if the darkness we're in is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if our country is not dying, but being born?" That's how I choose to see this moment that we're in right now. I know we're living in a world that is constantly changing, and I too have more questions than answers. It's why I'm here. It's what Unfinished is all about. The idea that we find better ways to connect and communicate, to provoke new ideas, to elevate unheard voices, to work together to make a bigger impact on our world. And Unfinished Live, this thing right here that we're doing, me and you, that's our way of introducing ourselves to you. I am not doing this by myself. This is not your typical Zoom. Also, you're welcome for not putting this in Zoom. Too many Zooms, am I right? I know I am. You don't have to answer that. The point is, you're not just here to Netflix and chill. You're not just here to sit back and watch. I want you, need you to be a part of this conversation, a part of this experience as we dig into what's possible now. So I want you to connect alongside me in the chat. Submit your questions, talk with one another, but start by letting us know where you're from. We'll be adding later polls and questions of our own so you get comfortable and get to know each other as we get to know you as well. The film you just saw is the beginning of our conversation. Because as you probably know, we're still living in a world where inequality and injustice are still too common for too many people, too often. That's what we're going to focus on over this next hour. What's possible now as we ask ourselves, what is a just economy? We're going to meet policymakers, artists, social innovators, CEOs, politicians, people like you and me, and ask questions about how things have changed and what change we can make to make things better. We're in this together, and it's good to have you from places like Santiago, Chile. I saw you, Geronimo. Guatemala, Monmouth, Oregon, Cleveland, London, New York, and my original hometown of Washington, D.C. I see you all there. We're in this together. And we're talking about things that are unfinished. It's right there in the name. But what does it mean for something to be finished or unfinished? When I hear the word finished, I honestly get a video game reference like, finish him. Like, that's a wrap. Something's over. But then sometimes I also think of it like furniture. When you finish a piece of wood, when you polish it and make it more perfect. Unfinished feels like incomplete. You didn't finish your homework. But also it can be a beautiful version of a conversation with a loved one that never ends. Every time you meet, you pick up, and it never quite finishes. We're gonna start with that idea in our next segment. It's called Finished, Unfinished. Two people will take turns reacting to prompts, ideas, and concepts by calling each idea either finished or unfinished. And both are gonna do their best to understand, consider, and respond to these ideas. I am pleased to introduce our two guests. Dan Shulman is the president and CEO of PayPal. The grandson of a union organizer in the Garment District of New York City, he has said he was born with social activism in his DNA. Quietly, I'm hoping he just slides some PayPal money into my account. I see you, Dad. And Darren Walker is a proud son of Louisiana and Texas and was in the very first class of Head Start, a program I was also in as a child. He's now the president of the Ford Foundation, which is a $13 billion international social justice philanthropy focused on challenging inequality. While those two talk it out, I want to hear your thoughts. We're going to do two polls in the chat asking you what you think is finished or unfinished. The first poll question, the American dream. Is it finished or unfinished? This is a question that Darren and Dan will answer as well. The second is another big one too, capitalism. Is it finished? Is it unfinished? We'll talk about your responses when we come back. Right now, let's hear from Darren and Dan.
Dan, it's great to see you. I'm a huge fan and I've been looking forward to talking to you about finished and unfinished. And so my first question for you is cash. Finished or unfinished?
Well, Darren, it's also a pleasure for me to be on this program with you. I've been looking forward to it as well. So let's see, cash. All right, I'm going to say finished, but I will say this. A lot of people have been predicting the demise of cash, and they've always been wrong. But here's what's happening. Clearly, the amount of payments going through cash is going down in terms of the overall percentage. And the pandemic has accelerated that by multiple years. I mean, people don't want to touch cash anymore. They're afraid that it's carrying germs. Something like 40% of the country says they don't want to handle cash going forward. So you're seeing an explosion in digital payments across the country and frankly, across the world. And now you've got governments that are thinking about maybe central banks ought to be issuing digital currencies going forward because it can be more inclusive, it can be more efficient, it can be safer and more secure. So I'm going to say finished, but it'll take a little bit of time. All right. So now I'm going to turn it on to you, Darren, and I'm going to do the exact same thing. So, Darren, the American dream, finished or unfinished?
The American dream is unfinished. I am a believer in this dream. I am a believer in the mobility escalator that made my journey possible. But I must tell you, Dan, I am worried about the American dream, that it is possibly headed for the finish line, that we will live in a country where there is so much inequality that it is not possible to live the American dream. So I don't want to give up on it just yet. So it is unfinished. Now, let me ask you, Dan, Main Street, finished or unfinished?
So I got to say on that, unfinished. I have to. Although there are worrisome signs about Main Street as well. Look, small businesses are the backbone of our communities and our neighborhoods. I mean, they have the vast majority of the shops in our towns, the vast majority of employment in our towns, but they are under a huge amount of pressure right now. They've always been under a lot of pressure, but the pandemic has really exposed the problem with small businesses is that they have something like 20 days of free cash flow, before they go out of business. And so when you have something like the pandemic just barrel down on small businesses, you're seeing so many of them living day to day in a very precarious state or going out of business.
But don't you also just feel viscerally that America without Main Street is a desolate, depressing, demoralizing country?
I totally agree with that. I think to just have a couple of digital giants or large companies and not have the diversity and the beauty of what is Main Street would take away so much from our lives. All right, I think maybe it's my turn now to go to you, Darren. I love this one, by the way. So, Milton Friedman, finished or unfinished?
Finished. The nail is in the coffin. We must never return to the ideology of Milton Friedman, because this idea of social responsibility by a corporation being a subversive idea was itself a subversive idea. And the ideology spawned by Friedman and that essay 50 years ago has done more harm to our society than the harm done by any economic theory, in my view. And I want to be clear, Milton Friedman was not a bad person. This is not a personal attack, but he put in place the intellectual architecture that every other idea got hung on. And then our business schools produced generations of business leaders who viewed their work as simply maximizing shareholder value. I think this has been an incredible disservice to our society and to capitalism.
I think that's exactly right. I actually think that you maximize shareholder profitability in the short term by doing things like reducing salaries or paying minimum wages that are barely living wages. It affects communities. It affects our economies. Ultimately, I believe over the medium term, not even the long term, the medium term, it actually takes away from shareholder value, because it takes away from the ability of our communities and citizens to be productive citizens. And so I think we're in an era now, I think you'll be glad to hear this, Darren, of reverse Friedmanism. And hopefully that will be the way going forward.
I hope you are right. So Dan, as one of the most fashionable CEOs in Silicon Valley, let me ask you the following. Neckties, finished or unfinished?
So finished. I mean, they should have been.
No, they can't be finished. What does this mean for Hermes?
Yes. Well, I feel bad for Hermes. Well, okay. Let's think about this. When were neckties first really put into fashion? So I think it was King Louis XIII in the 17th century that saw these Croatian mercenaries with this thing on their neck. And he thought, wow, those are really decorative. I'm going to require them for all royal gatherings going forward. And so think about that. Something that happened by the King of France in the 17th century that made you look more formal and part of royalty has existed with us through all of these generations going forward. And it's really actually amazing to me that that's happened. That, you know, in many ways, you know, they say that, you know, clothes make the person. And I completely disagree with that. I think it's actually the person that makes the person. And so I think this idea of having to wear a suit to convey who you are as opposed to the thoughts that you have, I think is very antiquated. And I think especially now in this sort of video conferencing era we're in, you know, it's really gotten informal. I hope it never goes back to it. All right, so let me go to you. Now I'm gonna give you, you asked me about neckties, so I'm gonna ask you this one. Black tie, is it finished or unfinished?
Unfinished. We are never giving up on the black tie. And let me tell you why. Because there is something to be said for being lifted up by the clothing we wear. And there is something to be said for acknowledging the specialness of an occasion, a circumstance, a celebration. And so I hope that we, in the post-COVID world, don't throw out our black ties. I have to also say that, you know, for many of us who grew up poor, who grew up black in the South, where black people only wore black tie as waiters, as domestics, to have the freedom to wear black tie as a guest on your own terms, in your own home, that there is something also quite uplifting about that. I know there are a lot of guys out in your part of the world who hate black tie, probably you too, Dan. But I'm telling you, there is absolutely at least one occasion in your future for a black tie. So please don't throw yours out just yet. It is not finished.
Well, you know, that's a beautiful answer. I would have said finished, but I love your answer.
Dan, credit scores, finished or unfinished?
So I'm going to say finished. I think this is a antiquated way of looking at somebody. I think today, with all the data and information we have, we ought to be using that in models that allow us to give more credit, working capital, to those who most deserve it, without being trapped by what was credit scores and really looking about what could be and this immense amount of data that we have. And we're doing that in PayPal, and we've opened up the ability to lend to neighborhoods where 10 or more banks have left. And those are neighborhoods where the median income is below the national average. And so we disproportionately lend to Black-owned businesses, to women-owned businesses. And by the way, here's the great thing, Darren, when we lend to those businesses, their average sales go up by 22%. So these are businesses on Main Street that desperately need that working capital. And when they get it, they put it to work and their sales go up.
I love it. And I think you guys are on to something. The future is not the traditional credit score. And I love that you're innovating and helping to provide solutions that will serve more people who have historically been left out of the financial services marketplace.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. Back to you, Darren. Privilege. Finished or unfinished?
Unfinished, because there will always be privilege in a society that is capitalist, a society that is democratic, because there will be talent, there will be skills and capacity that render certain professions, certain people in circumstances of privilege. But what we have today is a kind of privilege that is very harmful in our society, that is consistent with the kind of growing inequality. My question for all of us with privilege is not what are you willing to give back, but what are you willing to give up? That is the question for privileged, wealthy, advantaged Americans in October of 2020.
Such a good, provocative answer. Now, thank you for that.
Thank you, Dan, for this conversation. This finished, unfinished conversation with you has been a tremendous privilege for me. Thank you very much, Dan.
And Darren, thank you so much for me as well.
Thank you, Darren and Dan, for a really innovative conversation format. Thanks for the questions that got thrown into that pile. They came for Milton Friedman. They came for credit scores, and they came for neckties. The last one, I think there's still some good use for if you want to dress up, but the Milton Friedman and the credit scores can both see the exit as far as I'm concerned. I want to check back in with you to see what you've been saying in the chat on our first poll about the American dream. Is it finished or unfinished? Resounding results. 92% of you said the American dream is finished. Very dramatic, very dramatic. Here's one quote. American dream was a fantasy from the beginning, tainted by racism. And I really appreciated this one. I think it was Andres who said, we need a global dream, not just an American dream. Also, America's a continent, not a country. Way to fact check us on that one, Andres. See you, love you, appreciate you. My own take on the American dream is that we need to reimagine what that is. And by American, I mean USAian, Usonian, United Statesian dream, to be hyper-specific, that we need to imagine something more inclusive, more fair, and less wrapped up in commercialism and exploitation as a suburban house and 2.x children. On the capitalism question, is it finished or unfinished? A bit more of a split on this one, but still the unfinished said 71% of you and finished 29%. And the quote that jumped out to me from y'all on this one was, capitalism has been finished for the 99% of us for a long time. So thank you for that, for weighing in. On that note, we want to go to a similar question. We took to the streets and asked people straight to their faces, are you a capitalist? And we're going to hear those responses. After that, we'll watch someone who thinks a lot about capitalism and justice, Brandon Dennison. He's been working in West Virginia to transform its local economy. Let's take a look.
Am I a capitalist? There's so much more behind it that I don't even know it, you know?
They called America the land of opportunity. At its core, capitalism to me means freedom.
I do not consider myself a capitalist.
Am I a capitalist? Yeah.
like a lot of things, is good and bad.
I'm a person that cares about other fellow human beings. I think that is a conflict with a capitalism.
I am certainly a capitalist, but I also believe that we have to do some serious work.
Nobody cares about the next guy or the next woman, you know what I'm saying? Everybody's out for themselves.
You know, it's a system that allows people to die of starvation while we have a surplus of food.
I'm homeless out here. I sleep behind the rocks.
You have to make it work for you. And unfortunately, we live, you know, in a nation where it works better for some people than it does for others.
Do I consider myself a capitalist? It depends on the day.
I'm educated. I've been published. I'm sitting on the street. Why? Because of capitalism.
Most people don't get the things they need, whether that be healthcare, whether that be sufficient housing.
83% of the wealth in this country is in the top 20%, which is completely radical.
What it was designed to do, it was designed to work for some.
I think that if you work, the economy is good.
Of course, it's working for me.
When I'm free, I drive my taxi, but it's good.
When you make money, you can do whatever you want to do with it.
Everyone should have a fair shot at capitalism.
I just feel like, man, what we could do to make things better is just for all of us to come together.
Get the homeless off the street.
I think one way would definitely be a wealth tax of the top 1%, 0.5%.
We look at the system for what it is and don't see the opportunity for what it can be.
There was a time for me that it was hard for me to find a job. So I want the economy to be where it's like you could go out there and you're not struggling to get a job. It's like everybody to my dog got a job.
The system has to treat businesses as bad as we treat people, or treat people as good as we treat businesses.
Let's make it right. And that's what we need to do. Like?
When I say Appalachian person, really truly what comes to mind? Because there's a good chance it's a stereotype. It's a redneck or a hillbilly or a Trump voter. Appalachian people are tough and resilient and also resourceful, which is we have people who want to work, want to learn, want to be a part of something, but everything's just gotten so messed up here that there's nowhere to apply that gumption. We start new social enterprises in more sustainable fields. We helped start the first solar company in Southern West Virginia. We have an organic agriculture company. We have a t-shirt company, and the shirts are made out of 100% recycled content. So we start businesses that really model what a more diversified post-coal economy can look like. We use those enterprises to put people back to work. We're one of the few groups around that are adding jobs instead of cutting jobs. And as we show very tangibly what a new economy can look like, it starts to bring people opening up again instead of closing up. It is a really hard time in Appalachia. We're not asking people to take pity on us. I think really I'm actually asking people to believe in this region, that we have value and we have something to offer to the country. And the way to do that is do business with us, people, planet, and profit. And that would be my ask.
I believe in you, Brandon. I believe in Appalachia, and I love the way you told that story. It's a positive, aspirational, generative story, not one based just in pain, but also in possibility. I want to thank you all again for being in the chat. I'm hanging out there with you. You see my name pop up. That's really me. This is live. I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. And I think the very act of asking questions is a way for us to expand our minds. So I want us to do some mind expansion together, some legal mind expansion together in the form of questions. What are your most essential questions that you have on the economy and on justice? Add your question in the chat or at our website, unfinished.com, anytime. Your question may show up in a future episode. Now let's prepare to get into our next segment. Too often, interviews are treated like the extractive fossil fuel industries of old, just to suck information out of the human body rather than engage in a true exchange of ideas, interaction, human relationship. We don't believe in doing that. We want to have meaningful conversations, so we're doing something a bit different with the format. Unfinished asked you, our audience, what are your most urgent questions to ask today about the world, about your lives, about the economy and justice? And we took those questions and gave them to our next guest to ask each other. Let me introduce them to you. Julian Castro is the son of a civil rights activist from San Antonio and the grandson of an orphan from Mexico who moved to Texas looking for a better life for her family. He has used that opportunity to become the mayor of San Antonio. He served as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and he was a candidate for President of the United States. Abigail Disney is an Emmy-winning documentary filmmaker born into a famous family who has said that people who run big businesses make too much money. She said that. She said it to their faces, and that workers should have stronger protections and better pay. She's used her platform to push for raising taxes on the wealthy and to speak out about inequality. As we head into that segment, I want to ask you another question. Talk about it in the chat, and when we come back, I'll check in with you, get to some of your responses. Here it comes. Brace yourself. Question time. Is a just economy possible? And what needs to happen to make it so? Put your responses in the chat now, and we'll get to it when we return. For now, let's hear from Julian and Abigail.
Abigail, it's great to be with you today.
Great to see you.
So my first question is, what has come alive for you in 2020?
That's a really good question, right? Because we've been so focused on the things that have ceased to be alive in 2020. But I think that there's been an enormous amount of awakening that we've witnessed in other people that we felt in ourselves. And for me, to have watched the national movement around racial equality just absolutely erupt into an undeniable force has been one of the most powerful, humbling, beautiful things I've ever witnessed in my life in this country. And I really think that it's not just that that's come alive. I think it's come alive in a real way for almost every American. And it feels possible things could really change. What has come alive for you in 2020?
You know, a sense of appreciation for what I have, because my life has been turned upside down, like a lot of people's lives. And, you know, my family and I have been fortunate, but this year for me has been so different from last year. Last year, I was away from my family for 75% of the time. And for the last few years, I've been traveling a lot, not had the opportunity to see my 11-year-old and my 5-year-old very much. And this year I'm here 99% of the time, and I'm managing their remote learning, and I'm the stay-at-home dad. It's just a completely different quality of life and perspective. And so what's come alive for me is this, experience of family. Like, I haven't experienced it before as a father.
More broadly, in the United States, so many people have had the experience you have, especially men, frankly, who have often sort of been gone a lot, who've been home, first of all, feeling a little bit more sympathetic about how hard it is to have the dishes done and the laundry done, education. But more importantly, just what the rewards are of being with your kids.
For sure.
And I think that's something that men have not really had a lot of time to think about until now. And I've been so delighted to watch the joy that's coming out in the men I know who get to spend time with their families.
What is the new American dream?
That's such an important question, right? Because to say that there's a new American dream is to say that perhaps the old one is either outdated or irrelevant or whatever. And, you know, I come from a family that is the very embodiment of the American dream, that has built a whole, you know, media empire around living the American dream. So I'm very tuned into what that means.
The American dream is a car, the home, and
so that American dream has left the building. The new American dream, I think, is a version of the old one, except everybody's invited, because the old one that I'm talking about was, of course, available to my uncle, my grandfather, but not to the vast majority of people of color, of LGBTQ people, most women, et cetera. The new American dream should be seen as a dream that we all participate in, and that it's not just about the ascent of a single person or a single group of people, but the ascent of us as a human project.
Also, I think that in some ways it's not as materialistic. The old American dream was was based on, at least as I understand it, you know, you have the house, have the car, you know, live out, for many people, live out in the suburbs. And today, I hope at least that it's more about finding fulfillment as well, that the American dream is not just tied to material things, although you do need certain things to live and to thrive, but it's also tied more to happiness.
Yeah, I keep thinking that that materialism has infected all our conversations, and that instead of talking about feeding and housing and clothing, we should start with dignity. Because actually, if we started with dignity, feeding, clothing, and housing would come as a natural part of that.
That I think that's a great way to think about it. You know, a baseline of that we need to afford dignity, or not afford, that everybody deserves to be treated with dignity, and then go from there. How do you feed everyone?
You know, I'm just finishing this great book by Kurt Anderson called Evil Geniuses. And toward the very end, he does a really interesting math equation where he takes all of the $19 trillion in income in the United States and all the $100 trillion in wealth and asks the question, if you just took it all and divided it up evenly among the 330 million people in the United States, what would that look like? And everyone would have an income of $140,000 a year and wealth of $800,000 a year. It's a really interesting exercise because what it shows us is that, not that we should all divide it up that way and go our merry way, but that there is plenty. There is more than enough. In that scenario, everyone isn't just middle class, they're upper middle class. So we feed everyone, first of all, by caring about everyone enough to honor the dignity of a human being who has a very different life and isn't close to us physically, but we recognize their full humanity and dignity. And then we look at the resources that we have at our disposal and we figure it out. I think really almost everything is possible. What about you? What do you think is possible?
It strikes me that we're entering this season of change. I think electoral change, change based on all of the protests in the street this summer. And what I hope is possible is that we can heal as a country, begin the healing process from what has been a very divided time, a polarized time, a partisanized time, and also find a national sense of purpose, of identity. I think that's been one of the hardest things to summon, not just over the last 4 years, but for many years, is the same kind of sense of national identity and purpose, and fundamentally, as you say, a commitment to one another and what we're going to do together to lift everybody up. Can we find that? I believe that it's possible, but of course it takes good leadership and it takes buy-in from, you know, all of us as citizens, and you know, the question is going to be, are we committed to it? I think it is possible.
I think that leadership like yours, frankly, Julian, I just want to say it would be, is key to moving us forward in that way. I really do think of you as one of the best voices out there. And I really, I think it's possible maybe to have a moment with each other after this election where maybe, hopefully, God please, we've bottomed out and we can start checking back in with each other and building relationships.
That would be wonderful. For sure.
Yeah. I'm nothing if not an idealist in the family tradition.
I believe in the power of a free exchange of goods and services. Thank God. Let me start that over.
I am most certainly a capitalist, and yet there are some interesting nuances there.
I'm a nonprofit worker. I make my money from, you know, wage labor effectively, and so I'm not a member of the ownership class.
Yes, I do consider myself a capitalist. I think I would say I hope to be an enlightened capitalist.
I don't think I'm a capitalist. I don't exploit other people to make more money.
I'm a capitalist because I believe that the free exchange of goods and services between individuals is not only the right thing to do, but also leads to the greatest prosperity for everyone.
Capitalism is a system that celebrates entrepreneurship and working hard. And yet capitalism also has created the inequality that we're experiencing today.
It is perpetuating systemic inequities, primarily wealth, between those that have wealth and those that do not.
For the United States, the productivity per hour has increased 6 times more than the average wage.
We do face many obstacles, and any economic system is going to have those challenges. I think capitalism as a whole has delivered over hundreds of years and has increased wealth of the world from that standpoint.
I think over the last 40 years, we've seen really this market fundamentalism, which means that we're prioritizing profits above anything else. And so I don't believe that capitalism has to operate that way, but in fact, that is how it's operating today.
I grew up as a commercial fisherman chasing fish around the globe, sort of a pillager. And at a certain point, I decided that I wanted to collaborate with the ocean. And I turned myself into a farmer and began asking the question, what's unique about the ocean as an agricultural space? And that's how I ended up as a regenerative ocean farmer. We're at this moment where our seas are rising, and we can either build seawalls and flee the coast, or we can turn around as a society and embrace the ocean as a place where we can grow food, sequester carbon, create jobs, and really build a new economy out at sea. GreenWave's job as a nonprofit is to train 10,000 new regenerative ocean farmers in the next 10 years. And once we do that, we believe the industry will have a life of its own. Most people don't know that the majority of US territory is underwater. With our food system being pushed out into the ocean, with fish stocks under pressure because of climate change, we will be farming our ocean. The question is, what will that look like? Will it look like massive banana plantations out in the ocean with absent owners that are getting all the benefits while the rest of us just work? Or can it be something beautiful? So in its DNA, we have social justice woven in. We don't privatize our seed. The oceans remain commons. We create millions of jobs and an incredible amount of food to feed the planet. And let's have this be a beautiful future rather than sort of a dark, necessary one. We think of the economy as such a sort of cold space, right? A space where people want jobs and money. I think it needs to be a warm space, right? A space for the soul. Like, because what's going to activate all of us to come in and be part of the solution and wake up every morning and trying to figure out how to build a new climate economy is that there is a sense of meaning in it. I get to feed my community, right? So that's a fight that's worth fighting. We need to create jobs that fill people's souls.
I'm with Bren. I want that warm economy for the soul that embraces you. Also, I miss hugging people. Do you miss hugging people? I do too. I want to thank Bren. I want to thank Julian. I want to thank Abigail for their beautiful contributions to the program tonight. And I want to get to you in the chat because we asked you questions, and I promise you this is not one of those one-way things where we're like, please fill up the comments, and we just like go about our business. So let me reflect you back to you. In answer to the question, is a just economy possible? What needs to happen? Here are a few of the responses that jumped out. A just economy is not possible without a just judicial system. I really like that. We need actual rule of law, and accountability needs to be part and parcel of whatever system. Justice in the economy requires justice. It's kind of right there in the name. Someone else wrote, get money out of politics. And in so many ways, money has corrupted our political system, which doesn't allow us to have fair referees to adjudicate some of the disputes in our economy. We have another comment. Yes, we can have a just economy if we focus on basic human rights. And I saw a lot of universal basic income in there, but guarantees for healthcare, for housing, for education, some minimum dignity floor upon which we exist, and then capitalism kind of sitting on top of that, some version of that. And this one really jumped out to me. It's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism at this point. Tell me what you really think, though. I mean, that's putting a fine point on it. And I agree. I'm going to take a bit metaphorical, though. We do kind of need the end of the world, but not in like an apocalyptic way, just the end of the world as we know it, the end of the version of the story we have told ourselves about what the world can be. And I'm all for rewriting some of that story to make a better world. The last one that I pulled from the hat of your wisdom, we need to demystify the pick yourself up by the bootstraps mentality. There are structural barriers in front of a lot of us. And I really appreciate that. The bootstraps metaphor also just scientifically, physically, literally doesn't work. So if you're gonna have a put down for the majority of people who aren't in the ownership class, learn the language and let's come up with better metaphors, oppressors of the world. At any rate, the question that emerges from all this for me is, what does it say about who we are as a country? The challenge of creating a just economy. What does it say about our economic system and about how we interact with one another? I have some more questions in mind, big ones, like how do we actually usher in a different economy? What's the role of businesses? Part of the solution, part of the problem? Can it be both? And how do we make a just economic system not a one-time thing, but actually sustainable? Now, I know those are big questions, and here to get into them, we've got three amazing people who are here to radically reimagine our economic system. Let me introduce them to you. Angela Glover Blackwell is a national leader, writer, and speaker on issues of equality and opportunity. And she's the founder 22 years ago of PolicyLink, which is a national action institute, not a think tank, action institute, because they do stuff, working to advance racial and economic equality. Martin Whitaker is the founding CEO of Just Capital. They measure and rank companies on the issues Americans care about and help us use our voice, purchasing, and investor power to act on that knowledge. That last one is key. We often don't talk about the power of investors behind the scenes. They pull levers, make things happen, or stop them from happening. And finally, David Leonhardt is going to moderate the conversation. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist for an upstart online publication known as the New York Times. He also runs its flagship newsletter called The Morning, which you should read, well, whatever time of day you can get to it, because it's 2020, and I'm not going to pressure you to hit certain timestamps. Let's get into the conversation.
Thank you for that introduction. And Angela and Martin, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
Great to be here.
Let's start by trying to diagnose the problem just really briefly. And obviously, it's a big, broad problem. But when I look at what's been happening in this country for the last 30, 40, close to 50 years now, there are so many metrics that are worrisome. So as is well known, incomes and wealth for the majority of the population have grown slowly. Recently, we've seen all kinds of health metrics that look bad, whether it's obesity or diabetes or even life expectancy. We've had years where the average amount of time that Americans living has actually fallen, which is a fairly shocking metric for an advanced country. And so when you look across all of these worrisome measures, including the way that people in this country feel about the country, Angela, I'm interested, what do you think are the fundamental causes that are driving these worrisome developments?
I would say that the problems really focus on toxic inequality, unaddressed racism, and general division within society, and they all are interrelated. What we really are seeing is the consequence of not having dealt with race for so long. The health disparities that have been laid bare because of COVID, the interdependence that has really impacted the economy in ways that have been a tremendous shock that we don't really know how to get over. And then having to come to grips with race because of so many people having seen George Floyd murdered on camera really has caused us to have a reckoning. And if something positive comes out of the horrors of this year, it is going to be actually moving forward around issues of race, and a byproduct of that is going to be having an impact on health, the economy, and civil society.
Martin, how do you think about this?
What we're seeing over the course of 2020, and Angela's so right, it's unfortunate, it's taken a global pandemic and a reckoning on racial equity to bring us here, but we are here at this moment where most people now say, time out, this isn't working for me. I want a reset. And what I really need, you know, we're in a post-World War II sort of situation where we need a massive economic rebuild. And you cannot do that unless the economy is fully inclusive. You can't do that if you've only a few people are going to benefit from that. And, you know, we trace back all the data on inequality. We've seen all the adjust capital, all the corporations that we are tracking in terms of their performance on paying a living wage, building an inclusive, diverse workforce, investing in communities that need that, you know, need that support and need good jobs. We're seeing a sort of a willingness now, I think, an openness to change today that we haven't seen before. And so, you know, Angela's right. It's sort of like you're at this moment where it's a, you know, we're beginning to sort of see through the mist a path forward that unfortunately the events of this year has, you know, been required to bring us here, but you can see a way forward where more people feel like they have more of a stake and there's a willingness to change.
Can you actually foresee a way in which the corporate sector plays a bigger, better role in order, in terms of paying a living wage, in terms of addressing racial inequities, in terms of climate change? And if you can, how does that happen? Are corporations really going to change their behavior, or is the only solution here government action?
I like the way that you posed the question because you kind of cut through all my rhetoric around how to answer it. I just can't put a gloss on it when you put it that way, because I can talk about why it's essential, but you're asking, is it plausible? And I sure hope so. I sure hope so. And part of me believes that it is for this reason. It has become so essential. The fate of the nation is now dependent on the very people who have been systematically left behind. The people who are Black and Indigenous and Latinx, people of color. And the economy is dependent on it. The democracy is dependent on it. The economy is dependent on it. And it's happening at a time when corporations are reaching and trying to demonstrate that they get it. All the money that's being put behind Black Lives Matter and Black-led organizations, that's not going to solve the problem, but it certainly does send a signal that we're in a slightly different space than we've been in for the past 50 years. We also do not have a government at the federal level that is taking the lead. And so if corporations thought that this could be like the civil rights movement when the federal government stepped up in response to demands and started moving civil rights legislation and people said, oh, that'll just fix it. It is clear that we can't count on the federal government right now. So corporations have to take the lead. They have outsized influence. They have outsized influence and they need to use it to be able to step into this moment. I am not going to say that it's clear that it's going to happen, but I've never seen it more essential. I've never seen it more front and center. I've never seen so much dialogue about it, and I've never seen so many roadmaps for how to do it. I suspect that we're going to see some courageous ones step up and start to know what it looks like to be leading on racial equity and full inclusion, and that's going to start if public demand stays there, and if we can get government beginning to create the supports that are needed, I think it can happen. I can't swear to it, but I think it can.
It's interesting. I mean, in so many ways, American history, it's so hard to be optimistic about racial equity, right? Given our terrible history on this subject. And yet on this subject, and Martin, I'll be interested to hear what you think about this, in terms of the role of corporations, in some ways, I'm actually a little bit more optimistic about the role they may play with racial equity than I am about the role they're going to play on things like climate change.
You know, what this comes down to when we you know, look at what the role of businesses can be on racial equity, when we look at why companies should pay a fair and living wage, it must come down to the strong business case. You mentioned the long term. We've seen companies that looked after their workers over the last 6 months in the teeth of this pandemic have outperformed top quintile in our universe of 300 largest companies, outperformed the worst companies by about 20%. We've seen an annualized outperformance of about 100 basis points of the most just companies versus the least. These are companies that pay a living wage, have more women on their board, do better on investing in community. So the business case to me is strong, powerful, and getting more powerful year on year as these issues become more relevant to business competitiveness today. Just focus on living wage for a second. We oversampled this year Black Americans when we asked, what should companies do on racial equity? Number one issue was actually the number one issue across the general population, which was companies need to pay a fair and living wage. There are millions of Americans working for big corporations today that still rely shamefully on government support and assistance just to put food on the table. Now, you're not telling me that, you know, we want a marketplace where the taxpayer is essentially subsidizing shareholders. We're subsidizing our own inequality. So that's just madness. We need to get companies to recognize this is in my best interest as a board member and as a CEO of a company to lift wages. And the reason I do that is because I think over the long term is going to protect my franchise. I'm going to have a more engaged workforce that's going to be more productive. They're going to spend more in the communities where they live and work. And that's a pathway that actually creates a race to the top that more people feel like, to my point earlier, they have a stake in. That's the sort of system shift, the systems change in thinking and narrative. It's this myth that somehow I gotta, you know, buy back my shares or invest in shareholders or invest in workers. I can't do both. You know, that's just a myth. We got to put that to bed once and for all and realize the path forward here to create long-term growth, you know, for corporate America, for shareholders too, is by investing in stakeholder performance.
I'm normally the optimist in these conversations, and I feel like I'm playing a little bit of the skeptic here, but let me just ask one thing, which is, if you look over the last 40 or 50 years, they've been really good for corporate America. Their profits have soared. If you look at corporate profits as a share of GDP, they're very high. The stock market has done extremely well. If you look at the corporate executives who are running these companies, they've done extremely well personally, right? Their companies have done well profit-wise, and they've done well. So how is it that they're supposed to look at that world and say this version of capitalism isn't working for us? I mean, maybe in some kind of long-term, you know, way it won't work for them. But as Keynes said, you know, in the long term, we're all dead, right? And so I guess I'm not clear on why the status quo isn't working for American corporations.
You started off talking about why it wasn't working when you talked about a pandemic that is hitting people of color, people who are poor, people who have pre-existing conditions, people who are old. It's not working when we have that many people who are being left vulnerable by a system. It is not working when that pandemic shuts down the economy, because these are the people who are at the front lines. These are the people who, if they can't go, the economy can't go. It is not working when the distrust is as deep as it is right now, and it actually just follows racial lines in some communities in ways that are just frightening. That when you talk about the long term, in the very, very long term, maybe we're all dead, but we're going to all be dead in the very, very short term if we don't figure out that the long term is the way that we have to think. We have to stop thinking in the short term ways and look at what is inevitable when we look out to the future. And the other piece of good news here is that if we get the equity agenda right, we get everything right. If we get the racial equity agenda right, we actually have an economy that we can count on into the future. We get the racial equity agenda right, we actually begin to save the earth and the environment. If we get the racial equity agenda right, we get the angst of the baby boomers who are wanting to retire and they can't see their future. The median age for people who are white in America is 42. The median age for people who are Latinx, which is the fastest growing group among people of color, is 28. The future is dependent on people who are building families, building community, solving problems, and bringing creativity. What that does for the baby boomers, what that does for the economy, what that does for our communities, benefits everybody.
Let me ask you this, David. Do you feel like a company that invests in its workers will do better than one that doesn't?
I don't know. I would like to think that, right? But when I look over the last few decades, what I see is soaring inequality, very slow growing wages for American workers, and really strong corporate profits and stocks.
So play that out. How does that end? Look at the trend line and say, is that taking this country to a better place? You know, is that going to create the kind of economic engine we need to dig ourselves out of, what are we now, $6-7 trillion hole? Is that creating the kind of incentives that we need around the country to create and sustain good jobs and healthy communities? I don't think so. And so this is about, again, I come back to, we can talk morally all day long, but you want to frame this as sort of an economic systems change. And why should companies see it in their enlightened self-interest to invest in their workforce, in the communities where they operate, and very directly in advancing racial justice? And the reason is because it's going to be better for the companies how they compete, how they attract talent, how they invest in their workforce, how they serve their shareholders, all of those things. I'm not saying this is a direct line and easy, by the way. When we talk to CEOs of companies that we track, none of them will say, well, you know, I really am just in this for the short term, and I'm focused less. All I'm really focused on is short term quarterly earnings. They want to be focused on these other issues because they know it's better for business. So there's a whole other conversation here, which we're not really talking about, which is the role of shareholders and investors and their expectations, and the role that they can play in this process is really important to decision making, as you well know. So I just feel as though if we can just take a step back and say, these trend lines are not good, they are not healthy, and this is a way to really right this ship, this ocean going liner that we're on. It's not going to move on a dime. It's not going to happen overnight, but it is going to be in the long-term best interest of all of us to do so.
The other thing is all the people with power and influence who are asking, what can I do? Now, maybe they're not going to do the thing that's going to be transformative, but I have not experienced people asking at this level, what can I do? And listening. The money that is pouring into the infrastructure to be able to extend this moment with knowledge and advocacy and determination is quite impressive. And corporations are doing things they have not done before. And I believe with Martin that for the economy to thrive going forward, we are going to have to be more inclusive. And when we start to be more inclusive, we are going to reap the benefits as a nation, and that should keep it going. So I expect, and if my expectation comes true, we are all going to be living in a better place, that this is not just another brief second of racial awareness. This is the beginning of transformation around race. And if that happens, it will be better at every level.
Well, it's great to hear both of your optimism. After this incredibly trying year in so many ways, I think we can all use a little optimism. So thank you both for doing this, and thanks for the spirited conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
I started doing deep photographic storytelling because I kept arriving in really unique situations all over the world, and photography became the most portable medium for me. I found myself making deeper and deeper stories in communities that ultimately led to me becoming a National Geographic photographer. On these National Geographic assignments, I was going into communities that were often fighting for their lives, and the stories they wanted to tell couldn't be told in their entirety in the magazine. Amplifier was born out of that as a way to tell those stories. We take complex ideas and boil them down to very simple images and language to make people ask questions. My billboard was made from an image that I photographed at a previous wildfire in California. It's ultimately about realizing that our quest for more has started to destroy the world in a way we can no longer ignore. We're literally engulfed in smoke. How are you still asking if climate change is real? Billboards and public art wake people up. And to be awake, I think, is to understand the connection of our economy, our climate, our vote. If we change the model and make it about the stakeholders and about a living wage, regenerative versus extractive industry, capitalism and our economy can be redesigned to do less harm. Powerful photography and visual storytelling can literally change the course of human events, can change the laws, can mobilize people into the streets. When we think about our society as this tapestry, it's been purposely torn apart. I believe we have an opportunity to reweave that fabric. We're trying to make the compass that points to the future we want to live in.
I'm back. It's good to see you again. Why do you look for a sign? Do you even need a sign? When I looked at that sign and saw that one tree in that burnt out landscape, I'm reminded that a picture is worth a thousand words, and that scene is worth a thousand signs. And we should have seen enough by now to know it's time to do some things differently. What you just saw was a project that Unfinished and the Civic Organization for Freedoms launched together, inviting artists to share their most urgent question and turn that question into a billboard. There's currently a billboard with an artist question in every state in the United States. So what question would you put on a billboard? Yell it from a mountaintop. And some of you are near mountains. Hello, Chile, or should I say hola? But don't do it right now. Stick with me. We're going to bring it home. I don't want you to go climb a mountain just because I asked you. That'd be very weird. Instead, why don't you put it in the chat, your question, or head over to unfinished.com so we can talk about it in a future episode. As we bring things to a close, I want to thank our incredible guests, featured thinkers, artists, and workers who helped pull this whole thing together. Thanks to everyone who's been a part of this conversation about the economy and justice, about where we are, where we could be, and where we need to go. So what did we learn today? Where are we? I learned a lot. I learned that Ms. Blackwell, as I'm referring to her now, I just want to follow her on every matter and telling it like it is in terms of this economy. I learned that we can farm the ocean in regenerative and beautiful ways. I learned that Julian Castro is really excited to not be on the road anymore and actually get to interact with and spend time with his family and with his children. And I learned a lot from you and your comments. I appreciate the fact-checking, Usonians, not Americans, and the additions that you brought to the flavor tonight. I also think about this question, is a just economy sustainable? Can we make a just economy sustainable? And with respect to the program I am hosting, I would flip that question a little bit. I don't think the urgent question is, can we make a just economy sustainable? I think we have data in about the unsustainability of an unjust economy. So there's only one direction we can move, and that is toward more justice in this economic system. Let's do that together. We are in a moment when people are questioning the very structure of our economy, what we want, what we value, what we ask for, what we get. It's a moment of incredible volatility, challenge, suffering, and this year especially, death. Too much of that. But that moment is also a moment of hope. The tomb or the womb? What if it's both? What if one can help us lead to the other? Here's a very important part to all this. What's possible now isn't just a rhetorical question. It can lead to more questions, which we invite you to contribute at unfinished.com, because doing that starts something bigger, a conversation. And it's an opportunity for you to ask yourself questions. Questions like, what can we do differently? What change would I make? What action could we take that would cause the biggest impact? And the most important question, I know I gave you a long list of questions, but here's the most important element of all this. It's just the beginning. Every moment is an opportunity for a beginning. We could look at this long history and its tainted systemic racism and its unjust economic woes and feel burdened by that, or we can see liberation and the possibility of creating a new future. let now be a beginning for something new. It's certainly just the beginning of Unfinished Live. We have three more episodes still to come, and we will put the archive of this live moment on the website at unfinished.com later this evening. So if you know somebody who should have been here, share it with them. Go to that website, submit your questions that are most important to you. And throughout the series, we're going to be sharing them on the Unfinished Instagram account. So check in there and see if we shouted you out. Our next episode is on November 10th, when we're going to talk about democracy and voice. That will feature Valerie Kaur, who I've quoted multiple times in this episode, the tomb and the womb comment, Eric Liu, Yo-Yo Ma, Hank Willis Thomas, Krista Tippett, and Arthur Brooks. That's a very timely episode because we will be hopefully 1 week out from the sort of end of the longest election season in memory. Let's cross our fingers, our toes, and whatever appendages we have access to, that we have some resolution to this to set course for the United States, which sets course for so much of the world, whether you live in this country or not. Voting, if you haven't done it yet and you're eligible to do it, you got to do that. Like, you can't be watching me. You can't be hanging on unfinished.com talking about, I want a just economy, and you're eligible to vote and you haven't made your plan and executed it yet. Get on that. Democracy is people power. You are people. Claim your power in this version of the system. It's one of the tools we have. And if you don't use it, somebody else will. So vote, and then vote, and then vote, and then vote. Once, of course, but just, you know what I'm saying, reinforcing the idea that you should vote. Please, pretty please, seriously vote. Thank you for being a part of this conversation. Keep talking, keep listening, keep asking questions, and I will see you next time. I am Baratunde Thurston, and good evening. I'm going to walk dramatically that way now.